This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudiepod. That's slate.com/prudiepod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dear Prudence podcast. I am Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. And this week, we've got our guest, Joss Lavery, back in the studio, which is very exciting. I plan on fighting with him to the best of my ability. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about HR. We've had a number of office etiquette-related questions, varying from the minute to the devastating over the last couple of weeks. And I've been getting a lot of feedback of varying perspectives about whether or not going to HR is actually very helpful. There are a really interesting number of opinions that we've been getting in from people who have worked in HR. And I actually wanted to read to you part of a letter that I received from a former HR representative who says, basically, think of office operations like speeding. It's illegal to speed, but people do it all the time. It's not until they get caught that there are consequences. Big companies, like a red Corvette, get more attention, so they have more incentive to follow the rules. Small companies don't have the same incentives. There's no carrot or stick to keep them in line. The only way that a small company changes these things often is when turnover is really high and employees get unhappy and leave. But in times of a downturn in the economy, people can't just leave for another job where they get treated better. As far as the stick, small companies don't have any government regulators checking on them to see if they're doing what the law requires. This is the case with HR. No matter what the law stipulates HR should be, HR usually is just a sounding board to protect the business itself. HR is not an advocate for employees. Really, their job is to make sure the company doesn't get sued. That's it. They work for the company. So keep that in mind when people are writing for advice. They may want to know how to handle what they should do next. And any advice that just ends with, "Why don't you talk to HR?" isn't really helpful. It might be helpful in big companies, and even then, it's not a sure thing, but for small companies, this often isn't an option. And I thought that was a really good point. I've actually worked at a couple of smaller companies where there was no HR department or where the sort of nominal HR representative was also my boss, which can make it really difficult if your problem is your boss. And I'm sort of curious to hear. I have yet to hear from anyone who's actually worked in HR who said, "No, we're not just there to protect the company. You should come to us. We are here to help employees first and foremost." And I'm curious if there are any of you out there. Like, are there any HR employees or heads of HR who feel like, "No, we are not just there to protect the company. We're here for you. We want you to come to us." Because maybe there are a lot of you, and I just haven't happened to hear from you yet. But that is really tricky. You know, I've worked at a lot of places where HR would show up your first week to give you a gift basket and let you know, like, how to die online to get out. And that was sort of the last you would hear from them. And they were generally very friendly and usually got my name wrong, which is an interesting combination of, like, enthusiasm and being incorrect, which I find sort of charming, but isn't super helpful. So that's something that I'm kind of thinking about right now. Like, is going to HR actually useful for the average employee who's looking at an issue that's maybe frustrating but not quite worth their quitting over? Like, does going to HR actually do anything, or is that something that should really just be a last resort? Is it more useful if you're at a huge company? I don't know. So I welcome your input and your feedback. If you've had a great experience with HR where they just solved your problem and everything worked out, let us know, because I haven't heard a lot of those stories, and I'm curious if any of them are out there. Well, I'm really happy to have Joss Lavery back in the studio with us, because he is one of already like Hall of Fame podcast guests. Joss is an academic and a writer who lives in the Bay Area and a good friend of the podcast. And now he's going to help us answer your questions. Hi, Joss.
Hey, Mallory. Really excited to be back.
I'm so glad to have you back.
Thank you.
Go ahead and read this one, please.
So, subject: forever alone and happy about it. I'm a 30-year-old single mother of a 6-year-old son. I have not been in a relationship, serious or otherwise, in over 6 years, and spend all of my free time with my son and close family members. I don't go out unless it is for a family activity or something my son wants to do. I have close friends that I chat with online, but I really don't socialize in person with anyone other than my family. I am not interested in pursuing any type of romantic or sexual relationships with anyone, and have not been for several years. I feel very happy and fulfilled being single and independent, and don't foresee this ever changing. The thought of getting married, living with a partner, or even starting to date someone fills me with anxiety and dread. What is wrong with me? I am truly happy with my life the way it is, but my mother and close friends think I should be dating, or at least have the desire to do so. Are they right?
I think my favorite part of this letter is the fact that the sentence, "What is wrong with me?" is immediately followed by, "I am truly happy with my life the way it is."
Absolutely. What is wrong with me? I am truly happy.
Yeah.
Asked and answered.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah. I think you're doing great. Stay the course.
Yeah. Congratulations to you. The only thing to add is you've essentially written a letter to an advice column just to tell us how happy you are.
And I'm really proud of you for doing that. That's really charming. I wish more people would write in and say, like, things are great.
Things are great. My son's great. Yeah. Everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah. Should we pretend to see a problem here? Or should we play devil's advocate?
Well, there is a problem, which is that there is a thought of getting married, living with a partner, or even starting to date, fills me with anxiety or dread. You know, there is anxiety and dread in this letter. I guess the answer is something like, you don't have to get married. You don't have to live with a partner. You don't have to date.
Yeah. Yeah, that is one way to meet that anxiety.
Yeah.
A smaller problem would maybe be that this person's mother and close friends think that they should be dating, or at the very least, tell their family that they wish they were dating.
Yeah.
Maybe your family would be happier if once a week you complained. Maybe that would solve all your problems. Secretly, you're full of happiness and excitement, but once a week at family dinner, you say, gosh, I wish I had a boyfriend or a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then everyone sort of makes sympathetic noises and you carry on with the fiction for another week.
Yeah, everyone's got to feel some degree of pity towards everybody else in their life. So
yeah.
if you're really as happy as you appear to be, I'd be annoyed at you.
Maybe that's what it is. Everyone's just so sick of seeing how pleased you are.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what it is. I don't think that you're responsible for that.
No, this is good for you. Congratulations. I mean, you mentioned, I suppose I want to say this as someone who is raised by a single mother. You mentioned being a single mother. Go single mothers. Really fabulous.
Yeah.
It's hard and brilliant, and congratulations to you for doing it so beautifully.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like you have any serious problems with the way that you have arranged your life. I'm sure someone could read this and say, oh, you must spend time with people outside of your family, because what about when they all grow up and leave you? To which I say, that is transactional thinking.
Yeah.
I think you're not doing anything wrong. I think it's wonderful that you know your own mind. You sound like your life is rich and full. And I think you should remember you don't have to do any of those things. And you can just remind your family members that you don't want to date.
Yeah.
That you're quite happy.
You know, it's really great to hear from somebody who's happy being single. It's something, there's not a lot of movies that end with people happy being single. It often seems pathologized, and I think just really well done for writing this letter. It's inspiring, and I'm really happy for you.
Yeah, this is fantastic, and you're great, and I hope all the other letters today are just like this one.
Yeah.
All right. So this one is called For the Love of Money. Dear Prudence, my partner of 5 years is my favorite person in the world. When he came into my life, so did his financial baggage, loans, credit card debt, low credit score, and all. Knowing that his financial future would become mine, and because I love him, I offered to take over our joint finances about 2 years ago. He agreed, and we've worked together to educate ourselves, improve his credit, and our financial future. Our hard work paid off, and we saved enough money to buy a house and a car and raise his credit score. Due to his poor credit at the time, both pieces of property are in my name. We share the expenses equally and will file for joint ownership when we marry next year. That said, the fact that our property is in my name has been a sensitive area for him, which brings me to my problem. He's had a hard time breaking some of the spending habits that led to his financial situation, and it's hard for me to address this when the issue is so fraught for him. He started a new job in a high-pressure environment recently and has been incredibly stressed, which leads to retail therapy and eating out constantly. He says it's his way of unwinding, but it's gotten to the point where our joint account is noticeably shrinking between paychecks. We've had several conversations where he promises to do better, but then I review our bank statements and see charges for Uber, takeout, and haircuts twice a month. I've tried taking out cash at the beginning of the week and setting a budget for both of us, but that doesn't work. I've suggested meditation or therapy to deal with his stress, both things I rely on to manage mine. I'm so tired of having this conversation and not seeing a change. This is the only issue in our relationship. Everything else is great, but it's a big one. How can I approach this in a way that will actually yield results?
It's really tough, this one, I think.
Yeah. I missed the last question.
Yeah.
Actual problems for those days.
Yeah.
It also makes me think of the episode of Lady Dynamite, Maria Bamford's new show, where she meets Dean Cain because he's trying to buy her house. And she thinks this is sort of going to solve all her problems. And then in the next scene, her agent calls back and says, you know, he can't buy the house. He has the worst credit score I've ever seen.
He can't even rent a house.
He can't even rent a house. And his response, he just has this wonderful dopey look on his face. And he just says, what's a credit score?
Yeah. You're looking at me because you know that at some point in the last 10 years, I have asked that very same question.
I am looking at you because I'm sure at some point in the last 10 years, I also said something very similar to that. And if nothing else, I think you should start watching Lady Dynamite.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I think it would help you a lot as you sort of figure out what you want out of life. Mm-hmm. And also, it will renew your appreciation for Dean Cain.
And indeed, Henry Cavill, another Superman.
Henry Cavill's on Lady Dynamite?
Yeah, he plays the flatulent one.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that won't be as helpful to your situation.
No.
This sounds like you're doing a lot of work.
It sounds that way to me, too, yeah.
And it doesn't sound like it's making you very happy.
It doesn't sound like this person's very happy at all, no. And I guess money problems aren't like other problems in some way, because if you're using money to deal with the fact that you're stressed out about having no money, then you're just compounding the problem, and it's a very vicious circle you're getting into.
Yeah. No, and it's not as if I have no sympathy for that. I've, in my own life, often confused self-indulgence for self-care.
Yeah.
And I certainly understand how good it feels to buy something in the moment and to eat out when you don't want to do the dishes, and how in the moment it feels like such an instant rush of relief that you can mistake it for stress relief. But I think it's actually closer to an addiction. Not that I would suggest that your partner has a shopping addiction. I want to make that really clear. I don't think that that's what's going on here, just that that's the sort of behavior that gives you instantaneous relief and is not actual, that's not actual stress relief.
Right. No, it's short-term deferral.
Yeah.
That compounds the problem.
And it sounds like your strategies in the past have been, I review the bank accounts, I've tried setting a budget for him, and he hasn't followed it.
It sounds like the letter writer has been really active in trying to straighten out this person's finances, which is something I can understand at the beginning of a relationship. But it also sounds to me like they're moving into a phase of that relationship where maybe the letter writer wants to reconsider.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least wonder what... Do we know if it's a he or a she?
I believe, made some assumptions about their gender. The partner who's spending is an issue is male.
Yeah.
The letter writer, I don't believe, has made it clear whether or not they are male.
Okay,
so it could be a woman, could be a man.
Could be a woman, could be a man. I would think that the letter writer wants to work out what they can do to protect themselves and have that conversation with the partner. Whatever else that's going to lead to in the long run, I do think that the letter writer has so much on the line that, you know, Mm-hmm. Self-protection has to be an issue.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that you have to break up with this person. It's certainly possible to be in a relationship with someone that you love and respect and admire, but is so bad with money you would not want to commingle your finances. And
sure.
I think kind of a most challenging scenario would be staying together, accepting this is unlikely to change, and maintaining really strict separate finances.
I think that's right.
Which is hopefully not what you'll have to do, but is something that you should at least consider. I think it's really wise that the properties are in both of, or are just in the letter writer's names. I think this person doesn't seem like they're kind of ready to handle that sort of financial commitment or goal. But if you tried making a budget for them and their sort of only plan has been, I'm going to do better, which is vague, and it has more to do with a feeling than it does with any sort of specific goal or action. I think unless you see real signs of change in the future, you should look at separate finances. The next one is husband smoking. And once again, it's just like, how do I deal with something I can't stand?
I have been married to my husband for over 20 years. He is a smoker. I am not. I come from a family where all the adults smoked but me, so this was not a problem. All I ever asked was that he not smoke while we were eating and not to smoke in the bedroom. I have never asked him to quit, but have supported his several attempts at quitting. Once he quit for 2 years. He has always gone back. I know this is an addiction that he has to fight on his own. That being said, health problems and orders from his doctor made him quit cold turkey. He can't even have nicotine patches or gum. This was over a year ago. He still occasionally has cravings. I understand that. What is concerning me is that he blames me for not being able to smoke. He says that the doctor and I conspired with each other to get him to quit. He was in an accident that resulted in him getting a bone graft. Nicotine will kill the graft. His friends say the doctor is lying and that I am a controlling bitch for not letting him smoke anymore. His regular doctor prescribed antidepressants to help with the cravings, but he is still angry. I never know when he will lash out at me. His and my breathing quality has improved considerably, but that doesn't matter to him. We have a great marriage except for this problem. I don't know what to do. I don't argue with him when he accuses me of this. I just say that I would never do that to him and I leave the room. How else can I handle this?
So that's a letter that really takes a turn.
It really does.
I thought it was about smoking when I introduced it, and I would now like to revise my statement, having heard the entirety of the letter.
Revise away.
I think this is a letter about either someone whose husband has developed some sort of paranoia or hallucinations and requires a very different type of medical help than what he's been getting lately. Or this is someone who is in an abusive relationship and needs to get out.
Yeah, I would agree.
What are your... Yeah, tell me... Lead us on this one.
Well, I mean, clearly being in a relationship with someone who is accusing you of having conspired with his doctor to withhold medical information is a very serious situation. And I'd agree with Mallory that at least a first step would be to try to talk with a mental health professional about this.
Which, unfortunately, he might see as conspiring with a medical professional against him.
Sure. As to the other part, you know, one of the things that's so powerful about this letter, I think, is that, you know, this guy's acting like an addict. He's turned something that is necessary in his life, quitting smoking in order that his bone graft doesn't get rejected, into a paranoid conspiracy that the world is launching against him and for which you've become, unfortunately, the spokesperson. That's a disastrous and unsafe situation for you. And I would seriously consider, you know, revising the terms of your relationship with him.
Yeah, obviously, I have a couple of thoughts in my head, like what if whatever this accident was caused some sort of brain damage that has resulted in paranoid fantasies, which is kind of an elaborate way of reading between the lines. That may or may not be the case. I really don't know enough about the terms of their marriage.
And who are the friends?
That's my other question, right, is what kind of friends does he have that are reinforcing this irrational delusion? If your husband's friends are agreeing with him that you are a controlling bitch, if your husband is using the language controlling bitch, I would get out of the house, frankly. It sounds like you're already pretty good at leaving the room when he makes these accusations. I would go a step further. I would say, as long as you somehow believe that your doctor and I have conspired to keep you away from cigarettes by faking a mental health crisis, I can't.
A physical health crisis.
Right, yes, yeah. I can't.
Faking a bone graft transplant.
I mean, that's pretty outrageous. And mm-hmm. I think for your own safety, you should at least consider finding a place to stay with a trusted friend or a family member until you can kind of think about what you want your next steps to be, because this sounds like something that's really come out of left field and has started to escalate, and I worry for your safety.
Yeah, I agree.
Because you already knew you can't control his smoking. You can even less kind of control this delusion.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I mean it. I just have a great deal of sympathy. This is a really horrifying situation, and you know, there are support groups for people with serious problems with addictions. I believe there is one for people with serious problems with nicotine addiction.
Mm-hmm.
It really strikes me that this isn't a problem about a guy who doesn't want to give up smoking. This is a narrative about a guy who has developed, out of a desire not to give up smoking, a paranoid theory of his own existence.
Right.
And is taking it out on people who are trying to care for him.
Right. And I, like we said earlier, but I would really like to stress, is I do think your first step needs to be contacting his doctor.
Yeah.
Your doctor can't necessarily confirm that they're going to do anything about this because of HIPAA and medical privacy rules, but you absolutely should contact as many doctors as he's ever seen. You know, if he's gone through a bone graft, he probably has at least one or two specialists as well as a GP that he's seeing, and say, here's what my husband is doing lately. This is really out of character. It's delusional. It's paranoid. It's scaring me. And I can't seem to bring reality into the situation in such a way that he can recognize it. And your doctors should, his doctors should be made aware of this immediately. And I think I would certainly encourage him to go to therapy, a psychiatrist, assuming he would even be willing to.
Yeah, assuming he would even be willing to. It's the sort of thing where you can almost imagine couples therapy having some kind of initial effect, because no couples therapist, as far as I understand it, no couples therapist would ratify the paranoid fantasy even
right,
for a
getting
second.
Getting confirmation from an outside party.
Yeah.
And maybe that would be something that he could hear,
yeah.
Although he would maybe just as easily storm out and say, hey, you're against
sure.
me too. But it might be worth trying, if only to answer for yourself the question of, can we work together on this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like he's determined to cling to this fantasy, even if it's at the risk of losing you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say this is a really sad and bewildering situation. My guess is that it seems like some sort of mental delusion. It's also possible this is just a straight up abuse tactic, and he knows perfectly well that she is not conspiring with his doctor, but is trying to make her feel like there's something wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems less likely to me. It seems more likely that something's going on with him in his mind.
Yeah. I mean, we also do know that this person sees a doctor who has prescribed antidepressants to help with the cravings, but therefore he has some treatment for a mental health condition.
Right. And I don't know that paranoid delusions are ever a possible side effect of antidepressants, but again, it's worth bringing up with the doctor who prescribed them. Sometimes there are very rare medication interactions that can produce mania or psychosis or persecution complexes, and unfortunately, you are now going to have to do the exact thing that he thought you were doing, which is conspire with medical professionals against him. And I think probably for him, that will be not something that he can handle. And for your own safety, you will need to do so at some distance. And that's not to say that maybe someday with some sort of help, you two can't reconcile. But as things are now, I don't think that you're safe emotionally or physically in that house.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a very difficult situation.
And whoever his friends are not good people.
Yeah, the friends are the worst. The friends are just really stoking this situation.
Right.
I mean, provided that I'm assuming that you get the friend's opinions via him. So
right.
it's possible the friends aren't.
I hope very much that he is not inviting them over and kind of everybody ganging up on her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say take care of yourself. Get in touch with the doctors. Do your best. But if you can't effect change, remove yourself from the situation. this question is this what a midlife crisis is like? And I thought we haven't actually gotten to answer like a good old-fashioned classic midlife crisis question in a while. Or maybe ever, so let's take it away. Dear Prudence, I have a problem that may seem minor but is truly consuming my life. I work in construction. I'm good at it. I like it. It keeps me outside. I'm married to a beautiful, wonderful woman who loves me. We live in a nice apartment. Everything is great. Not perfect, but great. When I look at my friends' lives, I realize just how lucky I am. But despite that, I can't shake the feeling that I'm missing something. I feel like I was destined to do great things, maybe even amazing things, but I look at my life and all I do is build small office buildings and large homes. I drive past buildings I've worked on and I should feel a sense of accomplishment, but all I feel is sadness. I've taken to staying up late, researching exciting but outrageous, even ridiculous things that I might do. I started a physical training program that the Navy SEALs use, wondering if I might make a good special ops soldier. I spend weeks thinking that I might volunteer for one of those manned missions to Mars that are sometimes talked about. My sleep and my health are starting to suffer. My wife has noticed, and it's affecting our relationship. She looks like she wants to kill me most of the time, and I can't really blame her. I've gotten into counseling, and my therapist is helping me to deal with these feelings. We've started setting goals that are more achievable. He suggested that I take an exciting vacation, just me and my wife, but I'm not sure that it's going to curb this urge. Have I just developed a midlife crisis? Will this pass, or do I need to make some radical lifestyle changes? You must change your life.
You must change your life, yeah.
I'm not telling him to change his life. It's a poem we've talked about.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have said that.
Why? Because now we're going to have to talk about Rilke.
Now we got to explain the poem. And yeah. No one wrote into this column hoping that we would talk about Rilke. Like,
we don't have to talk about Rilke. I've got so much sympathy for this guy.
Yeah. I thought that you might, and I felt that I didn't have enough. And so yeah. I thought that I should bring you on board.
Yeah. No, man, I really feel what you're saying. Is this it? Is this what you get? I thought I could go to Mars. I thought I could be a Navy SEAL. Those things weren't exactly my goal. But, you know, I think what you're describing is very common and very broad. And you're going to have to find ways. This guy's going to have to find ways to define for himself what success might look like moving forward. He has done a very great deal that he can be proud of and takes a justified kind of pride in that. But that doesn't scratch the itch, and it's going to be a long process to work out how he can do that, I think.
That's a great answer, yeah. Yeah, no, I feel something quite similar, but just less kindly, which is just sort of like, yeah, you should figure this out, guy.
Yeah.
But I mean, his question is like, does this matter? And yes, absolutely. Like, the answer is like, your feelings of frustration and like you don't know what's meaningful about your own life, they absolutely matter. Like, obviously, you shouldn't use them to mistreat the people around you. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't use it as a reason to check out of other people's problems. Like, you're not the only person who has ever experienced this, so don't make the mistake of thinking that this is the only crisis. But it also does matter, and there's no kind of achievement. Like, it doesn't matter what you have or haven't done in your life. If what you're feeling right now is a sense of aimlessness and loss, like, that, mm-hmm. that does matter. You should pursue that. You should not try to stuff it down and just be grateful for what you have and ignore it and try to move on. Like, you should – it's great that you're in therapy. You should try to figure out what are things that do make me feel like my life is meaningful. Maybe that will be more vacations than therapy. And maybe that will be – do we think it's going to Mars?
I don't think it's going to Mars. You know, what I will say is that I think this is not a midlife crisis. I think it's actually part of feeling proud of one's success. I think it is the shadow cast by looking at those houses or feeling some pride in a job well done. Because as soon as one feels that, the homeostatic procedure of the brain starts going, but is it enough? If you didn't feel anything to be proud of, I doubt you'd be asking questions about Navy SEALs and missions to Mars. Those things, I think, somehow seem to go together.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're going to have to live with that dissatisfaction. I don't think there's a way to conjure it away. And bear in mind, if you did go to Mars, if you did become a Navy SEAL, you would have the following experience at some point. You'd be back in your family home at a family gathering. You would grab someone by the shoulders and say, "I went to Mars, goddammit." And you would look in their eyes and you would realize that person didn't care. And you would have to face some sense that even going to Mars, even all of the training that you'd gone through, the extraordinary fact of having been one of the first human beings to explore that terrain wouldn't be enough. You can't force. There is no objective standard for success. Being a Navy SEAL, traveling to Mars, inventing a cure for cancer, they're not going to cut it. Because there's always going to be someone that doesn't care. And you can't make them care. So you've got to make yourself care somehow.
Joss, thanks for taking us out on such a beautiful note. And we're definitely going to have you again on the show.
Thank you so much, Mallory.
Before we close this episode, I just want to remind everyone that if you're hoping you're going to be one of the first people to live on Mars, I just want to remind you that Kim Stanley Robinson says we're not going to be able to do it. And if Kim Stanley Robinson says we can't go to Mars, then Kim Stanley Robinson probably knows what he's talking about. If you're not familiar with his excellent series about terraforming Red Mars and Blue Mars, he's a fantastic science fiction author, and he wrote sort of the definitive series about, like, what would happen if we terraformed Mars. And then earlier this year, he wrote a really depressing article where he said, yeah, we're definitely not going to be able to do it. And it just makes me really sad, because I've always sort of figured in the back of my mind, like, sure, you know, the heat death of the galaxy is going to be a real bummer. But at some point, we're going to be able to fling some, you know, pods of ourselves into space and make it work, if not on Mars, then elsewhere. And he wrote a really convincing argument about, guys, I'm going to be honest, I don't remember a lot of it, but it had something to do with the bacteria in our guts and how they can't survive in the environment of space, and how that's going to be really difficult to move to another planet. I really wish I could remember more of it than just, oh, bacteria is going to make it tricky. But bacteria is going to make it tricky. So we're not going to be able to terraform Mars, which means we're really stuck here on Earth. And if Kim Stanley Robinson's given up the dream, then I think so should the rest of us. So if you were hoping to make it to Mars or any other planet, I'd like you to go ahead and quietly bury that dream now. Just let it go. Make a little headstone. Take a minute. Take a moment of silence. And reread Red Mars, actually, now that I think about it. Or that great Val Kilmer movie, which I think was called Red Planet. Anything about Mars. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Casey Miner. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. And remember, you can hear more Dear Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up now. If you like the show, please go to iTunes and write us a review. Reviews help new listeners find the podcast. And we know you all want to help people. Plus, we'd love to know what you think. Just search for Slate Dear Prudence. Do you know what I really wish we could do? Is, as you may or may not know, prudence is one of the four classical virtues, you know, as opposed to the three theological virtues that were later combined into the seven heavenly virtues that oppose the seven deadly sins. So it's prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude or courage. And I've been really wishing that, like, once a year we could flip. So I could be Dear Prudence 1 year, and then Dear Temperance the next year, and then, you know, Dear Justice the year after that, and just kind of cycle through all the things that the Stoics loved. Just like a year as Marcus Aurelius, just being like, does anything happen to you? Well, the universe wanted it. Suck it up and be the emperor of Rome. Which is part of why I love the meditation so much, because it's really just a note. It was like a series of notes to self that kind of only apply if you're the emperor of Rome. But a lot of people have enjoyed reading them and thinking, ah, I should also do these things. But I really think you should go easier on yourself since you're not the emperor of Rome. Anyways, all of which is to say, I would love to do a year where I was not prudent at all and was just like advocating fortitude. And it was just like, invade Gaul and Galicia. Like, get out there and, like, tear down the Vandal kingdom. And that would be my advice to everyone. Just a thought.